goddamn filco piece of junk.
Daddy, why are you getting the television?
Come on. Come on, I say.
For shadow photography on the
what did the TV ever do to you?
Quiet, bad.
Did the TV ask for money you didn't have? Like those bad men from the government who asked you to give them back tax?
Taxes. It was taxes, not tax. I know my voice is funny, but it's taxes.
And you ran them off the land with your shotgun, and you gave the other big man more money to defend you in court?
Now, quiet, son. This is history. Ain't every day that a man lands on the moon. I mean, I'm 38 years old. I've seen a lot of stuff.
Just like Neil Armstrong.
Well, I ain't sure I'm going to be here next year.
Look at those pictures. Wow. A little shadowy, but...
Do you love me, Daddy?
Well, I certainly love you more than them rockets.
Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
Okay, so I am here with Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez, who were, of course, the creators, writers, artists, and all-around impresarios of Love and Rockets, which is now celebrating its 30th anniversary. Gilbert and Jaime, how are you doing?
Hi, we're doing just fine.
Doing
thank you.
Great. We're happy to be here.
Okay. Where's Mario? How come he couldn't make it? How's he doing?
He's busy having a life and a job back in San Francisco.
Oh, I see. You guys don't have lives and jobs?
No, we're cartoonists.
Okay. So I wanted to go ahead and start off with the way that you two collaborate. I've noticed that the two of you sometimes riff off of each other's styles. In Jaime's Daughters of Doom, you have part of the Thai Girl Adventures. We see those six characters with the six separate balloons on the first page, which is a response to, of course, what you do, Gilbert, where you often have like six excitable people talking at the same time, often in the Palomar stories. And of course, many of the stories contained in your Luba hardcover almost have this naturalistic approach, which basically is almost in response to the Maggie and Hopi stories. So how did the two of you share techniques or stylistic tips with each other? I mean, do you guys, what's the communication like, both artistically and sort of organizing Love and Rockets as a whole?
Right. Really, nothing else but sharing the book.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we don't write our stories as far as bouncing off each other or anything. I mean, I'm just influenced by Gilbert just because I think he's a good creator.
Yes.
I like his style and everything. But no, we hardly ever collaborate. I mean, or never, actually. You know, it's just. It's just, I guess, because we're brothers and we work on the same book, we kind of egg each other on more than anything. So if you see anything that's similar, it's just unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we actually don't see each other's stories until they're printed in the book.
Do you guys review each other's art after the fact and see if you can sort of, I guess, improve upon it? What's the communication process after the fact of, say, putting out an issue and so forth?
We just need to goof on each other.
Yeah.
I'll say, why did you draw that new girl so goofy looking? She's got a new character named Tonta, which means dummy in Spanish. And she, he's just going all out with this funny, energetic teenage character. And that's when I get, that's really funny, and that's different from what you do a lot of the times. And, you know, we'll just riff that way, you know, more like on a personal level. I look at the character you did, yeah, you know, whatever, you know.
So there's no post-mortem at all?
Not really.
Oh, okay. So the two of you, I know, grew up in a household where basically, Gilbert, you were the one who passed down comics to Jaime. And I'm wondering, you know, I also see in your work, Jaime, a clear love for the Twilight Zone. What books did the two of you read while you were growing up? I mean, did you have someone reading Les Miserables to you over the bedtime or anything like that? Or what was the intake like?
We read comic books.
Comics?
That was it. We didn't read books.
Huh.
Because they're lesser than comic books, you know? They can't draw. They can only write. I mean, it's a lesser artist right there. I'm obviously goofing. No, we didn't have no interest in prose. I still don't have much interest in prose. I'm interested in the way the story is told through visuals and panel to panel. I'm completely, absolutely absorbed in the way comics are told. And, you know, after that, movies.
Yeah.
But, no, I respect prose, of course. I mean, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that that's not our focus.
Hmm.
That comes after the fact, actually. Somebody says, read this book. This is a good story. This is a good book. This is a good writer. Then we'll sniff it out. But we're not looking for it on our own.
Yeah. So you haven't read, really, Gilbert, much of the Imagical Realists? Or
not very much. I was surprised when people kept telling me that I'd obviously based my work on Gabriel Garcia Marquez, in particular 100 Years of Solitude. I never even heard of it until issue 14 of Love and Rockets. And then I finally got around to reading it. And I was surprised at the similarities myself. Mm-hmm. I was pretty surprised.
Well, I discovered one interview, Jaime, where you confessed that you could create an entire character based off of a single detail, such as a haircut. I'm wondering, when the two of you draw inspiration from reality, is it possible sometimes that you may have too many details to draw from? I mean, what room do you leave for the imagination to wander, or how does this work where you do find a detail and suddenly a character springs out of that? I'm curious how this works for both of you.
Yeah, when I create a new character, they're only half done. You know, or maybe they're just a quarter done. It's the actual stories that they're in that create them, you know, as I'm going along. You know, sometimes I don't know a character at all. You know, they're just there in the background with a different haircut or something. Yes. And I don't know them till later, till I have ideas for them, you know. But so a character's never complete before they go down on the page. You know, they kind of unfold because I'm discovering them as well as the reader.
Yeah. Is this the same case for you, Gilbert, where you can't have an entirely complete character before you actually pursue it? It's sort of similar to what Jaime is talking about here?
Yes, normally. I often have the design of a character for a long time before the character develops. In my Palomar stories, I have the character Luba, and I have her half-sister Fritz, that she was the character that I had the least to say about, although I was still compelled to put her in stories. And then lately I've been focusing on her more often because of that, because her character is developing so much slower than the other characters. And so that's the challenge for me, to create a new character after, you know, having 56 you know, established ones.
Yeah. So if the characters are so defined, however, over 30 years, how do you both come up with new stories or new angles on the character? Is this account for the considerable promiscuity, which allows more characters to crop up in the characters' lives?
It's just using my imagination and trying to picture people in real life, you know, and so there's always something, there's always growing in the comic, so it feels fresh to me, and hopefully to the reader. So a new character isn't that hard to, isn't hard to create, it's keeping them going is the hard part, you know, so some characters just don't work right.
Such as what? Have you had any sort of stumbling blocks recently, in, like I said, the last 5 or 10 years? What have you done to get beyond that, both of you?
I would say, like, I create a character and I kind of expect them to go further than they do, but they don't gel as well as, say, another character, because I don't know them, you know. I just, like, I can't picture them as a real person, so they kind of drop out, or they remain a secondary character or something like that. And then in another case, a character that I expect to be just background, I keep going back to them and I go, I want to explore this character more, and they become more successful, you know. So it's not really planned till I see it on the paper and they have a past. You know, like I've done them for 5 issues, then I can kind of, I know them better.
Changing the physicality, the hair color, the weight, does that allow you to see, say, someone like Maggie with fresh eyes, or even Penny Century? I mean, is this a way of working in this kind of semi-dark territory that allows you to find a new way, a new hook in? Or?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I give Maggie a new hairstyle or a new outfit or something, and it's new to me. It's like it's exciting, and I want to continue with it. It's kind of like a baseball player, like a pitcher who's doing really terribly, and then he shaves his mustache, and all of a sudden he wins 10 games in a row, you know. And it's that weird superstition thing, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, just because he shaved his mustache, all of a sudden, you know, it's changed his game, stuff like that. It's kind of like that with the characters, you know. I'll give someone a new hairstyle, a new hairstyle, and it'll all feel new to me, and all of a sudden I have 10 more stories for them instead of one.
So by that token, what's the ideal weight for Maggie for the World Series? Oh, okay, well.
Well, that's funny, just to add to that. It's funny that you mentioned that, just changing a hairstyle. All the times, it's not uncommon for a woman to cut her hair after a bad relationship. Right. You know.
Yeah.
It's right. It's kind of like Maggie. I put her through this story, and maybe it doesn't end out so happy in the end.
Yeah.
Well, the next time you see her, she's got bought herself a new outfit and a new hairstyle, and she feels better about herself.
Yes.
You know, things like that.
So do you two know when you're doing some one of these epic stories that goes on for, like, say, 8 or 9 issues? Do you have any preordained idea that, oh, this is going to be a very long tale, or do you just roll with it? What's the degree of planning? What's the degree of pre-sketching? What's the degree of considering the narrative in advance before you unleash a tale?
Sometimes they're not planned, you know. Sometimes it's like I plan to just do a 10-page, say, Maggie story, and then it'll start to gel, and it'll start to have more to it, and I want to pursue it, and it goes longer and longer, you know. Sometimes I plan a big like, this is going to take up 3 issues, and then it ends up 15 pages, you know.
Yeah.
It just depends on what I find out while I'm doing it, you know, whether it needs to be 3 issues or 3 pages, you know. So it's almost like I'm not going to know till I've done it, like I've been saying.
So how do the two of you manage, like, okay, hey, Gilbert's going to roll big time with, like, some 20-page story. How do you balance the so that everybody gets equal time, or do you not worry about that too much?
We don't worry about it because we basically have 50 pages in each Love and Rockets book now.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's pretty much. In the last issue I had more pages because Jaime was working on completing Gods and Monsters.
Yes.
And adding quite a few pages. That's a whole book that he added, you know, the worth of pages that he added to that. So he backed off a little. And I took 10 extra pages for this issue, and then it's in the next issue. He's taking his pages back, but by having 60 pages, I'll have 40, and we'll do it that way. But that's the extent of sharing the book. That's the extent of shifting things around. Normally, we have our pages. If he wants to do a 50-page story, and if I want to do a 50-page story, we'll just do it. There's no, although I prefer, if I know Jaime's going to do a 50-page story, then I'll think, I'll save my 50-page story for this issue, and I'll do 10 stories, just to make the book fun to read.
Yeah.
Because Love and Rockets is, to us, is like comics that we read as kids. You got your fun summer annual to read as a kid, and that's why I still see Love and Rockets. It comes out in the summer, It's got, this story, that story, you know, your little summer fun package, almost, but for grown-ups. You know?
Yes. So let's talk about extreme qualities within character. I think of, like, Jaime's Doyle Blackburn. I mean, here's a guy who has to be as raucous and as violent just to match the wrestling and the punk rock and Maggie and Hopi. And then, of course, there's Isabel the Witch Lady, where you actually physically change her size. Now, Gilbert, you're more inclined to sort of see someone like the IRS collector who dresses in a gorilla suit and Girl Crazy, or even the Forced People in Scarlet by Starlight, and of course the representation of them in the sequel to that story. So to what degree do you feel that this transgressive behavior, this extremity, needs to be predicated in reality? How important is it to stray from real behavior, and how important is it to keep it real? How do the two of you sort of deal with things that are almost hyper-real in service of a story?
Well, for me, it's basically, even if I want to do a story about, you know, scientists from the future in the forest, and there's animal people living with them, I for that kind of story, you balance how much is going to be a part of us there, and then what it's going to be like in the future. So, you know, it's a bit of a balance. And so I was dealing with scientists and these forest creatures. So for that story, it just felt like there should be a human connection in it, like some real sympathy for the forest people. Forest people didn't know what hit them, and the scientists could care less about them, but there was that superficial attraction one scientist has for the one girl. Well, you know, there's, and then I'm toying with the whole fetish aspect of that furry thing. With the fans of that sort of thing are called furries.
Yeah,
they have this, you know, sort of a fetish for sexy furry animals. Okay, yeah. I'm getting in trouble here. And so naturally, I drew the forest girl as sexy as possible, so that would trip up the reader and feel really weird about being attracted to her, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, okay, there's that on the surface and there's that going on, but it's important to have the human element within those stories, and that being the most important thing.
But you also twist that exploitative quality on its head when you have, of course, the massacre later on in that story. So, you know, I mean, it seems to me that you almost want to play with the idea of exploitation while simultaneously give in to various transgressive behavior and so forth.
Well, I just threw a bit of ugly reality in the end that, yes, even though the humans are hanging out with the forest people and they treat them relatively well and everybody's getting along on that end, you know, there's that drop inside a lot of people that the moment they get the opportunity to exploit people, they'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's more of a criticism of people than animal creatures.
Sure.
Cat people.
Well, Jaime, how does transgressive behavior work for you? I mentioned some examples at the head of that last question. You know, how much does your characters have to be steeped in reality, and when do you feel the need to stray from it?
When I'm bored with reality, and I and seriously, when I just want to have fun, it's a goof. Like I wanted to, you know, the story about Izzy growing big.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throw a big curveball just for the hell of it and see how it would fly with the reader, you know. And I don't know why, but I'm not, when I'm doing that, I'm really not worried about ruining the reality of it, maybe because it's just something I grew up with in comics, that the real life and fantasy go together kind of thing, you know. Like I said, it's all just having fun and just goofing, you know, but I do have the responsibility of keeping the reader there. I mean, you know, making it real for the reader.
Yeah.
You know.
But on the other hand, I look at a story like Brown Town, which deals with sexual abuse. It's a very heavy topic. And I say to myself, you know, well, I have to ask both of you, and also Farewell My Palomar. Do you think that comics need to really grapple with this extreme heft in order to really matter as a medium? Are there any areas emotionally that you have not tapped that you really see Love and Rockets going further as? I mean, you know, I think it has to be grounded in reality in some way, don't you think?
Right. Yeah. Okay, so with a story like Brown Town, there was no room for goofing.
Yeah.
Because this is serious stuff. Yeah. You know, and it was I wanted to tell a real story that, you know, tragic or otherwise, it was just really serious, and I didn't want to almost make fun of it because it's a serious issue. When I go there, you know, I get really serious and there's no room for goofing. In the case of Izzy growing giant, no one was getting hurt.
Yeah.
You know, so it was fun. Everyone got to go home and live their normal lives after that, you know. But in Brown Town, this was serious stuff, and I'm not going to mess with it.
Yeah. So there's an inevitable emotional filter you will have to apply fitting the story, depending upon how people are going to get hurt or not.
Yes. Yeah. If it's, you know, I only goof when it's safe.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, what about you, Gilbert? Do you feel the same way that a certain emotional tone requires a certain narrative filter to a story, that you have to be explicitly serious or explicitly ridiculous or fun in order to actually pursue a story? I mean, how does this work for you?
Sure, it's the same thing. Like, I mean, like you said, he's dealing with an unfortunate aspect of childhood that's real for some people. He's going to all of a sudden our brain goes into that mode. You know, this is going to be told this way, and I'm going to leave all the goofy stuff off and all the distractions out of it, because this is how the story's told. Even though uncomfortably, this is still an entertaining story.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to tell it as a story, as you're reading a story. It's not a lesson being clobbered over your head. This is a story about characters, but it reflects on a problem with that happens to children.
Yeah.
So I approach it the same. I have done serious things like attempted suicides and goofy stories,
yeah.
and I didn't think that was right. I thought, that's not something I want to do anymore. Because that was when I was learning. I was learning to tell stories. And then one of the first stories I did, it was a guy who attempts suicide.
Yes.
But it was in a science fiction story. And I got that uncomfortable feeling like, well, that, you know, yeah, the reader looks at it like, oh, that was a very shocking scene. And I thought, well, that's, you know, it should have been about something. Not just, you know, gorillas and out from outer space or whatever. That's the problem I have with mainstream comics, because they're always trying to elevate the superhero by having drug problems and suicide attempts and stuff. And I just think that's not where I'm at. That's not where I want to read that. I suppose there are good stories about that in a Batman comic, but
yeah.
It makes me uncomfortable to read it that way. I kind of dismiss the seriousness of it because there's a guy in a bat suit in it, you know?
Yeah. So are there any other stories that the two of you regret doing that you would have done differently along these lines that you were just learning out, you didn't really understand the gravity of what that story was trying to say? Any other examples?
Nothing really, really, earth-shattering, but you know, there's parts of The Death of Speedy I look back at that I could have just put a little more into it.
Yeah.
You know, when I did it, it felt right. When I, years later down the road, I look back at it and I go, well, I could have explored this more on this part. And then there's a part of me that goes, no, but it's been done. It's over. You know, if I want to correct it, do it in a different story.
Yeah.
You know.
So what emotional terrain do you think you haven't tapped that you fear to tread or plan to tread or something along those lines?
I'm sorry.
Is there any specific emotional terrain that the two of you have not tapped and perhaps would like to tap or would like to try, or is it just that it's just purely verbose? That you would say
it's, you know, I don't know what that would be. It's not there yet. So yeah. we usually discover that as we're formulating a story, as we're working on a story that's going to build. That's when it comes. It's hard to think of that ahead of time for us, or for me at least.
Yeah, same here. Let's say I'm doing a story about a Maggie story, and it's going a certain way, and then I start to think about some serious issue, and I say, well, what if I turned it into this? And I go, well, it's not, wouldn't fit. You know, I would have to think about it harder, think about it. I would have to write around it. I couldn't put the thing just blam, all of a sudden in a story. You know, Maggie's having fun eating lunch and then something tragic happens all of a sudden. It's like, oh, wait a minute. No, I would have to write around the tragedy instead of just throwing it in any old time.
Yeah. Well, both of you have resisted superheroes and referring to the comic book industry for a long time until recently. Penny Century finally gets her wish to be a superhero in the early portion of the news stories, and I'm wondering why you resisted the whole superhero comic book self-referential notion for so long. I mean, and why you inevitably succumbed to that impulse to portray it in Love and Rots.
I just didn't want to do superheroes anymore. You know, I just wanted to tell more real life stuff. I thought stuff I had seen in my life was much more interesting to me.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was not being seen in comics. And I kind of took advantage of that, you know, and I kind of, you know, outgrew the superhero thing, by the time Love and Rockets came. So, by the time I did the Tie Girl story, I was just wanted to have fun doing my own superhero comic. Basically, I mean, nothing.
The allure just kind of came back for some
reason. Yeah, it was just for fun. I just go, hey, I'm going to do a superhero comic and I'm going to follow through to the end and see how it turns out. Just for fun, you know, just for like that's what I want to do right now. Yeah. Gilbert always talks about this, that Love and Rockets has always been a comic book that he could explain this better, but a comic book, and whatever we want to put in there, we put in.
Yeah.
Whatever interests us, you know. So it's like, whoa, you did a serious, really serious true life adventure. Now you're doing superheroes. What the hell is that about? Nothing other than I just wanted to do a superhero sure. story the next time.
So, and we don't try to elevate the superhero thing in Love and Rockets. It's superheroes are fun. Affectation. They're just about fun and doing nutty stuff. And if you have some characterization in there and some pathos, that's nothing wrong with that. That makes a story, you know? But we never think that we should, like in the new Dark Knight Rises movie, we don't think that, well, to elevate this, we must eliminate Batman.
Yeah.
He's in it for 15 minutes in a 3-hour movie. You know, it's like, I came to see a Batman movie. Where's his car? You know, where's the Batsicle? No, this is better than that. Well, why do I want to see something better than that? I wouldn't go see this stupid cop movie if Batman wasn't in it.
Yeah.
I'm serious. This is how I feel. The stuff doesn't need the elevation. It goes back to the movie Greystoke with Tarzan. It was a flop because it wasn't about freaking Tarzan.
Yeah.
Oh, here's the serious Tarzan movie. Let's get rid of Tarzan, what he does. And this is this dumb elevation they do in mainstream comics where they're trying to elevate superheroes because they just can't let go of Batman.
Superheroes are inherently silly.
Yeah, or fun.
Yeah.
Or adventure characters. That's okay with me. I'm okay with Star Wars being about nothing but action adventure. Indiana Jones, you know, the new Avengers movie was successful because it was a matinee film about the Hulk being funny and all this goofy stuff going on, but it was a lot of fun. But then they try to elevate the stuff, and that's what keeps me away from mainstream comics. It's, here's the new Batman comic, but we elevate it to the drug war or serious crime stories. And I go, okay, but where's Batman?
Yeah.
Where's he doing stuff? Batman does stuff. He doesn't wear that costume just to mope. He uses the costume to do stuff. So anyway, that aside, I'm just, the Lone Ranger, so having superheroes and doing all that kind of stuff, thank you. It's about... Jaime is just doing superheroes to be fun, and it's part of our comic world. I like to think of Love and Rockets as it's a comic store with a lot of back issues.
Yeah.
That's what Love and Rockets is.
How much does this idea of elevation plague Love and Rockets today? I mean, in recent years, comics have become this super commodified, mainstream, pro-geek, geek is the mainstream now type of situation. How has this affected Love and Rockets, and how has Love and Rockets over the years been affected by economics and commercial forces? Has this really been as much of a consideration? Have there been certain storylines, certain characters that just audiences have rejected and you've had to make adjustments for or anything like this?
We really don't think about that much. I mean, we just do our comic and hope it won't be bumped off the shelf. You know? Serious, it's that simple. I mean, we just want to do comics that we think are good. And have our share of the comic store.
Yeah.
You know, it may be naive of me, but I really don't think about what's going on around me when I am doing my comic. It's just me and my comic, yeah. and I'm just happy that I'm able to do the next issue without starving.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, how long during the Love and Rockets run were you doing this with other jobs and so forth? And what did you do to make sure that you got your pages in for the next Love and Rockets issue over the years when you were doing sort of simultaneously employment? Or was it pretty much full-time most of the way?
Right. Well, there was a time when we were starting the comic that it wasn't, you know, really going anywhere financially.
Yeah.
But so I had to get a job as a janitor on the side, you know. And... But then when Love and Rockets kind of started taking off and I started going, hey, I can support myself with this because I was young and all I needed was an apartment and maybe a car,
yeah.
You know, and just taking care of myself. I had no responsibilities. So it was easy to live pretty cheap with Love and Rockets in the beginning. And I was able to quit that dumb janitor job. And...
Roughly around when were you able to quit the janitor job?
Mid-80s. I mean, like about 3 years into Love and Rockets. And I would say I realized, hey, I can afford my cheap little apartment. I can, maybe I can even buy a car, you know, and stuff like that. And as I got older, Love and Rockets started to sell more.
Yeah.
And I started to get more responsibility. Yeah. I got married. you know, and I started to think like a grown-up, but luckily Love and Rockets was helping me get there. Yes. We were both growing together kind of thing. So like I said, in the carefree days when we didn't have any money, I didn't care.
Yeah.
I was just young and carefree.
Yeah. You know. Well, has the influence of responsibility and money adjusted your freedom on Love and Rockets to a certain degree, or have you felt relatively free despite responsibilities?
Yeah. Besides responsibility, I've always kept Love and Rockets in its own little safe
compartmentalized
pocket.
No
matter which way my life was changing, you know, whether you know needed to buy a house or whatever, or raise a child or something like that,
yeah.
I always was able to keep Love and Rockets separate from that. You know, I would live, be a dad and a husband, and then I would go away to my room, and then I was the comic artist.
Yes.
You know, I was able to. So Love and Rockets, as far as art wise, has always been left alone. You know, I've always made sure that Love and Rockets that it was able to flourish artistically because nothing else could interrupt it.
Yeah. Is it sort of safe to say that this was the case for you too, Gilbert, in terms of Love and Rockets and responsibilities? You were relatively free to carry on and not really care too much about commercial forces or economics or anything like that? Or?
Well, economic forces have always been a concern of mine just because I want to keep going. I want to keep making comics and not get a job that takes me away from it. I learned early on that no matter what we do in Love and Rockets, we're just not going to be the hit comic that sells as much as Spawn or Dark Knight Rises or whatever, Dark Knight Comics or whatever. It's just not. It wasn't going to happen. We plateaued as far as that goes. But the responses as a comic book, as art, has always been good. It's always been good. We've had our ups and downs with phases of what people are interested in comics. But we maintain our position of doing the comic we want to make and that the readers like and our publishers like. So thinking about the next issue of Love and Rockets is going to be the one that makes it. There's a tiny bit inside of me that hopes that, but I know reality says different. So I have to do other comics to make a living, really. And luckily I have the type of personality I can do that. I can. It's tiring doing so many comics at once, but... I'm usually working on three comics at the same time.
Sure. Why do the two of you find women so much more interesting than men, especially their curves and their butts?
Well, just look out the window.
Looking out the window, and I could see that the attention to butts in comics certainly applies in real life as well. So, you know, I was curious to sort of get some insight into that particular interest of yours, both of you.
On the surface, it's obvious we like to draw the women, and that's no denying, you know. Like to draw women. I like to draw women of all shapes and sizes. Also, but there's that responsibility of making them human, you know, as much as I can. The first day, the first time a woman ever told me they liked my women characters and said, you do women right. I said, good, because I like writing women. I like exploring the whole thing.
Yeah,
I mean
the whole package, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, soul and physical form.
Yeah, and I've always had when I got older, you know, in high school I was terrified of women, that thing, you know, but when I got out of high school and I started to be friends with women, and I just liked hanging out and being friends with women as well as men, sometimes more so, you know, and I just started exploring that in the comics, and like I said, I got good response right away, and I thought that's cool, and I liked the fact that our comic, the women were in charge, there were more women running the place in our comics than most comics, you know, and kind of took advantage of that too. Like, I don't think they do women very good in these comics over here. I'm going to show you how. I'm going to show you what I think is a good woman character, and it was only positive from day one.
Well, I also wanted to ask. Oh, yeah. Actually, I wanted to also ask you about some of the stories that are more visual in nature. You know, Jaime, Whoa Nelly is this visual, almost exclusively visual love letter to wrestling. And then I think of also Gilbert's Hypno Twist, which is an extremely strange story told entirely without words. You know, is this deliberate formalistic restriction an effort on your parts to find a new place in comics for you to both grow as artists? How do sort of the purely visual stories come about? And, you know, maybe you could also counterbalance that with how words play a force sometimes in these narratives.
Most of my stories start with a simple indulgence.
Yeah.
It's just rolling up my sleeves and saying, I want to do a story without words.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. That's how it starts. And then I start to formulate it, and then I start to work on it, and I thought, well, I'm going to use this character in it, and it comes together that way for me. I literally see somebody else's work and think, oh, this guy's really great at doing pantomime strips. I've always liked pantomime strips. I love the old comic strip, The Little King, where you have to read it just by knowing what goes on panel to panel.
Yeah.
Well, I just felt like doing a dark version of that kind of comic. It was just because, well, I haven't done it. I really wake up in the morning, well, I haven't done this sort of comic yet, so I'll try that, you know?
Yeah.
And then it becomes this epic thing, and which is even better for me, because I like when it opens up and becomes this long story, because I always feel I cheat myself when I do a short story. No matter how much I work on a short story, I think there could have been 10 more pages to it. Not necessarily 20 more pages, but 10 at least, or maybe even 3, but something. I guess we just have this, like I said, we have this comic shop of in our head, this endless, with endless back issues,
yeah.
You know, and in the old days, there was every subject you can find in a comic book. You know, it wasn't this rigid thing of superheroes dominating. Now, I have different theories about the superhero thing, even in the days of so many comics, because we grew up in the 60s. Superheroes have the edge, even now to me, even though I love so many different comics, because the master of comics, of mainstream comics, is Jack Kirby, and he worked exclusively in superhero comics at the time. So I can't argue that. So if people say superhero comics are the best, and if they say Jack Kirby, I can't argue. I zip my mouth and say, you're right. I love so many other comics. I love so many different things. But if you want to talk superheroes and you want to show me a good Jack Kirby comic, you are right. So I have to back off on that.
Yeah. What about you, Jaime? What are your thoughts on just the purely visuals and sort of aligned with Gilbert that really it's just a matter of just wanting to pursue something, some visual dream inside your head that you can't shake?
Yeah, just like he said, you know, this next comic, hey, I want to do it about wrestling, you know, and then there's that thing, okay, I want to do about wrestling. Well, I better follow through.
Yeah.
Can't just go, oh, I was just doing about wrestling, and then it tanked. Oh, well, you know, I got to answer for that.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, so there's always that responsibility of following through and having fun doing it. Like, I just got to draw, it's kind of like I got to, what we used to call as kids, I got to draw action poses, you know, like the old superhero comics or something, you know. And so I focused on action poses. How many different action fight scenes can I do? You know, things like that. And how many, real wrestling moves can I put in there that I know, you know, like arm locks and
have you actually gotten into the ring during to actually try out wrestling moves? Do you act this stuff out? Have you two acted out any of the action?
No, I'm the guy in the audience.
Oh, okay.
only the sex scenes.
So I was a wrestling fan since I was a kid, you know, and so it's all a backlog, like Gilbert says, in your head. And I go, okay, I'm gonna do a wrestling comic. What do I know about it?
Yeah.
Throw it all in there.
Yeah.
You know.
I have to also ask about some of the children-oriented stories. Your kids tend to be drawn with very big heads, and every often I will see the sort of wavy Charlie Brown pattern on the shirts. And I'm wondering about the influence of Peanuts on these children's based stories.
Oh, great influence.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just kids' comics. We grew up on Dennis the Menace comics, was basically the same. He had the same shape, the big head with the little body, you know. And I just, when I do kids' stories and I do them cartoon like that, it's rare that I do realistic looking kids.
Yeah.
It's because I just find that style perfect for creating a child's mood and world. You know, there's just something free about that loose cartoony style.
By making a kid less realist, you're able to kind of tap into sort of a child's fertile imagination.
Yeah, I guess so. Truthfully, sometimes because it is hard to size up the real anatomy of a kid next to a grown-up, I swear.
that is
really hard. Drawing a... I know the skeleton of a grown human being without thinking.
Yeah.
I think of a child and I go, well, how many heads high are they? How many, you know, what grows faster, their arms, their hands? You know, because it is a scientific thing that the way we grow up, sometimes our arms are longer at a certain age. Sometimes our torsos are longer. You know, our heads are bigger. The top of our head is bigger, you know. And I don't have that. I don't have that science completely down.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, I could draw a grown-up blindfolded, you know.
So what anatomy do you guys pretty much have down pat? I can probably guess, but, you know, but what other weak spots in anatomy are you still working on, similar to the kids that Jaime has said? Gilbert, do you have any sort of spots you want to...
Weak spots? I don't...
Well, let me...
Go ahead, finish.
Yeah, sure.
Well, there's certain weaknesses I think I do have with angles of a person's head, or like the back, or looking forward, looking down. You know, I do have to work at certain things harder. I can't think of any specifics off the top of my head, but there are things I do have weaknesses with, where I do have to think about it and labor to get that right. You know, and to juxtapose it with the shoulders and the body, or you know, things like that. So they're just harder to get through, and I'm not the type that will research a photo of that. I will, if I'm looking through a book and I see that angle, I'll try to remember it.
Yeah.
But something about researching that stuff, I just don't.
Huh.
I don't do.
Memory works better than simply mimesis.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. Is that the same with you, Gilbert?
I'm a much more limited artist, so I'm struggling with, you know, drawing the bodies in a proper way anyway. So you'll notice my positioning of the characters is a lot simpler, a little more iconic than Jaime's. Jaime's is more naturalistic. And Jaime's even complained this about himself, too. We do get lazy with hands. We'll just draw hands real stiff instead of articulating, grabbing a bottle or whatever, you know, the way a hand really does, or the mic, you know, I'll just draw stiff, you know, a Barbie hand, you know.
It's not worth the effort to you? Or?
No, it's just I'm not good at putting that much detail, and then it distracts from the rest of the art. Well, the rest of art's not drawn that way, so I just try to keep it, all the art kind of matching each other.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm a very limited artist that way, so... Like the real problem is scaling children, like he said, because I'll have a 5-year-old kid and it'll come up to an adult's knee.
Yeah.
Well, that's an infant.
Yeah.
You know, but in a comic somehow it works.
Yeah.
You know,
perspective basically.
It's completely wrong, and the anatomy is completely wrong. I mean, a 10-year-old kid comes up to your waist.
Yeah.
Well, in our comics they come up to your thigh or knee.
Yeah.
So it's that's difficult, and it wouldn't be in the real world at all. But you get the illusion that it's real.
You soaked up a lot of movies. Have you also looked into, say, optical theory to think about force perspectives and this dilemma of, like, well, it may look like it goes up to the knee, but you need to have sort of that kind of slightly exaggerated look in order to sell it to the reader. Have you given any sort of study into theory like this, or is it all intuitive?
It's all eyeballing.
Eyeballing?
Just eyeballing, really.
Yeah. I know the basics of perspective, you know, vanishing point and stuff, and I do use the vanishing point all the time for backgrounds and things like that, but no, it's mostly eye stuff. Like if you took it apart mathematically, it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But looking at it, your brain accepts it as what it is. You know, like, okay, this is a person walking down the street with buildings. That's all I need to know.
Sure.
You know.
It's funny that they do that in film, because I thought that was something that works on in drawings.
Yeah.
The forced perspective, false perspective,
yes.
Just to make a point, to get the illusion right. But, you know, I learned, you see a little bit about that in films, because when Warren Beatty made the Dick Tracy movie, they showed how much forced perspective is in it.
Yes.
And I always thought, that's weird, because movies don't need that. I thought, personally, yeah. But I guess they do. I guess it's the same thing. Yeah. You know, a train going nowhere, a building's going nowhere, but it gives you that illusion that there's so much depth to it. And so I started looking at old Hollywood movies and how the art directors and cinematographers were doing that all the time.
Yeah.
This complete forced perspective that I thought was fascinating. But our eyes catch it, our brains absorb it, and accepts it. So I didn't think you needed that in film, but they do it a lot, all the time.
Yeah. So, Gilbert, you have an early story, An American in Palomar, gets into issues of cultural exploitation, and you have Howard Miller. He wishes to capture the human condition, in quotes. Mm-hmm. The story concludes with a riff on Einstein's quote about mediocre minds. I'm wondering, have either of you ever felt that you were exploiting your own culture or not respecting it entirely with your stories? And how have you dealt with this?
No, never. I just thought... they're all my pals. They're my girls. They're my pals. They're my friends. They're my enemies. They're the kids in the neighborhood. No, I'm just not afraid to be precious about it. You know, really, I just, you know, I love what I love and I don't like what I don't like, and that's all it is. I mean, I never think that this has some kind of cultural weight until somebody tells us about it. Then we get the college professors telling us, well, there has cultural weight, and you didn't emphasize the church and how the church plays into the family, and you didn't
really
emphasize the drug wars going on. Like,
you guys get letters from academics with leveling complaints and stuff?
No, just when we do these appearances, we'll get those, or at least the questions.
Okay.
You know, devil's advocate questions. So fine, that's fine. But they're always disappointed to say, like, no, this is just peanuts with Mexicans. You know what I mean? There's no, it's not... I don't think along those lines. If it comes out that way, it comes out that way. And if it's read that way, okay. But I have no... I never think, you know, I have my fist in the air thinking this is a Latino story that must be told.
Yeah.
It's more of a dramatic device or an observational thing that I've seen that happen. And so that'll be part of a story. And if people read it that way, they're you know, super... you know, fine with that. I'm fine with it. Well, whatever the reader takes from it, it's up to the reader. And like Hymus has been saying all week, it's a shared experience. We create the comic the way we want to. We want to share it with the reader. And the best part is when they like it. That's it, really.
So if people co-opt Love and Rockets as they're sort of like, hey, this is the pro-Latino comic, or hey, this is the pro-indie comic, this is something you just can't control and you just don't even want to deal with.
Oh, well, we don't want to reject it either.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if it's going to get us trips to the East Coast and speak at universities, that's fine. No,
yeah.
I like when the reader says, you know what the story was about, and it's about this, and it's about the Latino community, and I say, it sure is. Because it is. Yeah. That's what he read. That's what he got from it. He's energized by it. So what am I going to do? Tell him, no, it was really a Mighty Mouse story that I transmogrified into a Mexican story. No, It is that. If you read, because that's how we read. That's how we. A lot of our inspiration is through interpretation, our view of what something, of what we thought it was. You know, so many comics we read as kids, we didn't read them.
Yeah.
We looked at it and wrote our own story.
Yeah.
As looking at the pictures. Dan Klaus just said that in an interview recently.
Yeah.
He didn't read all the comics he had. He looked at them, and it was more interesting to come up with his own story, just because that's how his brain works. Well, that's how we did it as well.
Yeah.
I don't know, there could be some complex story of people talking in a room, but we had no idea what they're saying. But what if they're saying this? And what if they're saying that? Or how can I use that scene in a story of dialogue?
Yeah.
You know, of about dialogue that's completely different.
So positioning in the real and positioning in a comic is going to get your brain going and thinking of a new character.
New story, new angle on a character.
So what's the craziest misinterpretation of Love and Rockets that the two of you have ever heard? Out of curiosity, it just has blown your mind. Like, what? Like that?
It was this week. Somebody read something. Oh, okay. There was a... I don't want to say crazy because that's making my readers dumb or something,
yeah.
You know. And I didn't,
unusual.
And that's not what I think. Yes, or something that they interpreted that I didn't, you know. Or and didn't intend, or something was in the end of the Love Bungler story.
Yeah.
Some people thought, as I was jumping at the end of the story, when I was jumping time, you know, jumping ahead 2 years each two or three pages.
Yeah.
Some people thought that one of the moments was the fantasy, wasn't the real life.
Yeah.
And I thought, how'd they come up with that? You know?
Yeah.
And I said, no, it's all real. It's all real. It's just jumping into time. But I do remember when I finished the comic, and I have to read my comic like the reader after I'm done.
Yeah.
And if something's wrong, I go back and work. But I remember thinking like, oh, they might think that this is this is fake, or this is fake. One of them is real, and one of them is fake.
Yeah.
Is fantasy, and so it's just things like that. And then I hate to say it, but there's once in a while there's a reader who just reads into it like, what? I don't know what planet you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, but I can't bring myself to go, you're crazy, man, get out of here.
Sure.
Because that's not me, and it's not how it should be.
And it's because it's the reader's perception, and it's theirs. So, you know, unless you wanted to correct a technicality.
Yes.
Because, you know,
yes.
That they got confused. Okay, that's different. But if their perception, their absorption of the story is that, and that's what the story is for them, you know, and I'm okay with that personally.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've had the trouble of where a reader actually misinterpreted a story, but they kept pursuing me to pursue it the way they pictured it, and that's when I had to tell them, you know, no, that's not it. You know, you got to back off because
they were adamant.
yeah, that's when I got to stop them on their tracks, you know, but.
Well, so sort of on a similar tangent, how important is willful blindness, or just kind of concentrating on going from one panel to another? How important is this to your work? I mean, you say you go back to the beginning and you have to look at it as a reader. You know, are there often situations where you're surprised by what you put down, or situations where you have to correct certain pages because you were in that kind of zone when you were actually putting it down, anything like that?
That happens all the time, yeah. Sometimes it's a joy to just go from panel to panel, you know, because you just don't feel like thinking. You just want to go on autopilot and start drawing a kid walking through the forest, you know, and that'll become a story. Either, and you might remove it from the beginning of the story and put it toward the end or in the middle. We know how to rework our pages, and we don't like to waste pages.
Yeah.
And you'll see that Jaime's stuff is pretty much there. You'll see a lot of whiteouts, changes in mine.
Yeah.
And Jaime's, you see pretty much there. But I've seen, in the old days, I used to see his art, and I would see something that was going to be for the beginning of the story, and he said as the story went on, it fit better, the sequence fit better, and another. You have to do adjustments like, well, they weren't wearing these shoes, so you got to kind of fix the shoes, or the pattern of the socks, or things like that. Or make their mouth open, because now they're talking, whereas they weren't before. You know, and the other things, in the old days, I used to surprise myself all the time that I must have been on some kind of zone when I was writing something and draw it. And I look back and I go, I wrote that? I'm surprised. I don't go back to look at my stuff often at all anymore. I just think it's too dense. It gives me a headache to look at it. But I am surprised at how much I put of myself in dialogue and stories that are
in
pages. Like, wow, I did that.
Yeah, for the most part, it's usually a positive mistake instead of a blunder where you went, oh my God, what have I done? I ruined everything, you know.
Yeah.
That's rare, but it happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, so how do you keep that surprise alive this late in the game? I mean, how do you keep things fresh? Or are they as fresh as they have ever been for you?
Every issue is new. Every issue is the next issue. It's a new drawing of that old character. It's a new angle on what they're doing. And even if we go back to something they did 30 years ago, that's okay, because we haven't seen it in 30 years. You know, I'm okay with that too. Yeah, every issue is new. Every page is new. It's a blank page. It's, you know, oh, I'm drawing so-and-so again, and it's a new drawing. You know, it's new. I guess I don't know when it'll ever get old. I don't know if there's a point. Because, you know, this happens to artists all the time. Well, there's a point where it's just not moving anymore. And there's nothing going on. That's nothing for us. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's like doing a Maggie story. I've been doing Maggie stories for 30 years. I can have 47-year-old Maggie walking down the street, and then she meets up with somebody. Well, 17-year-old Maggie did that too. But 47-year-old Maggie is going to treat it differently because she's older. She's in a different space of her life. So that helps keep it fresh that, you know, that, see, this ain't 17-year-old Maggie, so hopefully it reads differently. And hopefully it'll go in a different direction because she is a different person. We're different people. You know, that saves us sometimes.
Well, that's a good place to end. Jaime and Gilbert, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, it was our pleasure. That was a fun interview.
All right, thanks.